Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 12th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim. I'm president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, an author. He's also the host of the Capital Record podcast and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. And he's live from Lancaster, PA. Hello, David.
From the financial capital of the universe.
Have you ever been to Hershey, Pennsylvania?
I have. And as a matter of fact, the reason I was last in Hershey was because I was supposed to be in Lancaster. There was this gigantic Christian music festival in the 90s in Lancaster that I attended several times. In 1 year, it got like rained out. It was like a Christian Woodstock. There were like 60,000 people. And it got rained out and they did it at Hershey instead. And I thought Hershey was quite nice.
It's an amazing town. If anybody...
I haven't been there in 20, probably 25, 26 years. Yeah.
You will not be surprised to know that it's largely unchanged. It's almost like frozen in amber in some respects. The museum about Mr. I can't remember the guy's name. It wasn't Hershey. Gosh, what was his name?
Willy Wonka.
Willy Wonka. That's his name. But the way in which this guy set up his company, he built it around this town. Of course, it was a working town, a company town, but in the best sense of the word. And he even had a sugar processing plant in Cuba until the revolution, I think it was. Anyway, a really remarkable place to visit for those who get the chance. Hey, this is David. I wanted to say that in April of 1986, this is the year that Clint Eastwood became mayor of Carmel. Are you a Clint fan?
Of course.
Yeah, his movies are awesome.
And by the way, I'm also a big fan of you giving a historical tidbit from something after 1974, which is pretty rare. 1986 for you is like yesterday. This is like modern history.
I have children who were born in 86.
You've done California history tidbits on this podcast that predate Christopher Columbus, which I'm pretty sure is not accurate.
Well, I wanted to say that long before we had Donald Trump, you know, a celebrity, a free market advocate. I don't know if Trump is actually a free market advocate.
Is that yeah. Okay?
Sorry. Yeah, that was overmuch. No, but it's fascinating because Carmel was at the time, at least according to Mr. Eastwood, who was running for mayor, it was this stodgy city that was, you know, kind of like Hershey, locked in amber for the tourism industry. And he ran on an interesting campaign. He wanted to sort of liberate the market in the town. That's how we might put it here, by which he meant he wanted to roll back some of the overweening kinds of planning commission activities in the city, one that would limit his ability to expand on some of the property that he'd purchased in the city. But he attacked the point of the sort of the moral high ground and won it by pointing out that the city banned the sale and consumption of ice cream in public. Don't know where this regulation began, but it was still in place in 86 when he ran. And everybody said, yeah, that's kind of stupid. And so he wins. And remarkably, he stays in office just 2 years. He is noteworthy for not taking the job so seriously that he adheres to the norms of office. And this infuriates a lot of people. He would, in fact, just talk to his neighbors who appeared before the city council and talk to them as humans rather than in that sort of stentorian sort of the official vernacular. He would just talk to them like people. But after 2 years, he said, you know, my work here is done. And he retired from the city council and never ran again. And then, of course, he appears in 2012 at the Republican convention. Where was that? It was in
Florida.
Well,
you know what? You're skipping a pretty big thing. Please. Here. So he became mayor of Carmel in 86.
Yes.
And he did appear at the Romney Republican convention of 2012. Right. But what happened in between was that Clint Eastwood was the key player in an investor group that bought back Pebble Beach outside of Carmel in Monterey Peninsula from the Japanese that had overpaid like $1 billion for it. And so there was this huge conservationist thing. Now, don't get me wrong. It was very market oriented. They made a fortune but they put together a team. Peter Ubroth of Newport Beach and former Olympic commissioner of LA Olympics in 84. He was a key player, but this was Clint Eastwood as a Carmel, you know, a son of Carmel, so to speak, put together one of the great real estate deals of all time. Had membership, people had to play the course, and they had kind of a fractional ownership. But like you nowadays, we think about an asset like that, like there would just be a line of hedge funds looking to come overpay. This thing was going to go to hell, man. And so Clint was quite a savvy operator. He was.
And what's interesting,
why are we burying the guy? He's not dead.
No, he's 90. He's not dead.
He's 90? Well, okay.
I hope he's not listening. Or I do. We love him still alive. But you know what's also interesting about that time, David, and though you were, what, 16 at the time, 86 to 88, and you've got the widespread fear in America that America was dead, not because of the Chinese or anybody else, but the Japanese.
Well,
do you remember that?
Well, yeah, of course there, I do. I talk about it all the time.
I just wrote
an article for National Review last week about my latest thoughts on the Fed and inflation and things. And I talk about the 30-year deflationary spiral that Japan has been in, created by an excessive debt and then treated with more excessive debt to keep this negative feedback loop of deflation going. And I point out that Donald Trump paid $100,000 in 1987 to take out a full-page ad in the New York Times condemning the U.S. surrendering economically to the supremacy of Japan.
Hmm.
And so look at me today with my history. It's like I've been reading all about John Sutter or something.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But I remember at the time, because I was, believe it or not, back then, I was coming out of my Marxism in the late 80s, early 90s, and I was a business writer. And I can remember the stinky little orthodoxy that if we didn't emulate what the Japanese did with their highly integrated banks and government and economic development policies and the barriers they had erected to free trade, you know, in terms of imports into Japan. And I can remember writing about this and just thinking, like, this is insane. The Japanese are going to die. Their birth rate was already declining. Their social services were very, very expensive as a result. And sure enough, the country's been in you would know better than I, but it seems that it's been in a multi-decade slide toward kind of mediocrity. I mean, it's still an amazing, at least superficially, an amazing country. But it does seem that its pinnacle in the 80s is this investor pool, basically, that went around the United States buying up landmark real estate was terrifying to Americans.
Terrifying. And the Pebble Beach thing was the apex. It was the marker. They bought Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, and they bought Pebble Beach. And those were the moments in which people said these at the time it was somewhat nativist and nationalistic, but it hadn't happened before. And I'd like to think it wasn't necessarily even connected to the fact that 40 years earlier we had been in a war with them. Maybe for some that were dealing with the residue of World War II generation, that was a factor. But I just think it was more any nation, the idea that an economic superpower was coming in and buying our trophy properties like 30 Rock and Pebble was just unfathomable. And then they overpaid so badly. There was a time when the real estate of downtown Tokyo was being valued higher than all the rest of the real estate in the world.
Wow.
And so when you say a multi-decade decline, you're being very nice. Japan is in a multi-decade decline that the world has never seen. And it is a rich country. It is not suffering from an uneducated population. Illiteracy is often the highest correlation with poverty. Japan has no illiteracy. It's suffering because of an asset bubble that blew up that was then treated with excessive government spending, zombie banks that they wouldn't let go under, and fantasy land monetary policy. Now, my view, maybe I sound a little nationalistic here, I'm putting my own American interest, is that God let Japan happen for the last 30 years to teach us Americans a lesson.
And we've learned it.
Well, we at least have observed. I would add, and this is an area that we had been performing much better than Japan until the last decade. It's also a lesson in children. You cannot sustain a society without children. And I'm really sorry there's some people that don't seem to understand how this works. Because a lot of people, especially kind of younger, less family-oriented, hip people that are really proud of their incredibly independent lifestyles that don't require the sacrifice of having to deal with any pain-in-the-butt kids. You know, I can walk around Upper West Side and look at these smug single 40-somethings also. But you know, just in terms of math, so everyone understands it, when everyone dies and then there's no kids underneath them, then your society dies. Just stop me if I'm saying anything confusing.
It's a little complicated.
And Japan had an incredibly high amount of old people. I do think they live a long time there. There's maybe something genetic, something in their health habits, but they age well, and they don't have any younger people to support it. So they had an upside-down demographic tree, 250% debt to GDP, which is double what we have, and it's quadruple what we had 10 years ago. And they've been at 0% interest rate forever, trying to continue to use funny money to try to treat all of it. So Japan, we talk about like, oh, America better be careful. Look what happened to the Roman Empire. Well, and I appreciate, you know, 1,500-year-old examples as much as anyone. You probably are going to have a story next week on a pioneer in California who came straight from Rome in 400 AD. But truth be told, Japan in 1995 is a pretty damn good lesson for America. I don't even think we have to go back to the fall of the Roman Empire. And no. So there's my little hobby horse for the day. The Japanification of the United States perhaps keeps me up more than any other economic issue that we face.
Well, that's a wonderful segue to the next story, which is about Nancy Pelosi's staffer going to the SEC, David.
Oh, man, I was so freaking nervous that you were about to do this breakthrough story of Nancy Pelosi getting COVID. And can you imagine if Joe Biden got COVID and, wow, there were all those people there not wearing masks?
Unbelievable.
Dude, I am so sick of conservatives thinking it's funny to dunk on these people for doing what we just told them 6 months ago to knock it off and a year ago to knock it off. Who cares if these people have COVID and no symptoms? The people bashing him for it don't care. They don't think it's a relevant story. They just think it's funny, like, to poke at it. And all it's doing is validating this even being a conversation. Who cares if Nancy Pelosi has COVID? Knock it off.
She has something worse. She has a track record, I think, of misunderstanding American finance in the same way that we talked about Japan not understanding its own financial self-interest. And, you know, here's the headline. Pelosi advisors among Biden's nominees for SEC commissioner slots. The senior advisor for Pelosi is Jaime Lizarraga. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Lizarraga.
I would say it's probably about a 5% chance that you're pronouncing it right.
Lizarraga. I think I got that right, including the trill door.
That's about right, yeah.
Thank you. But here's what's interesting to me about this. Lizarraga is a California-born guy. He went to the University of California, San Diego, is raised, according to one bio I found here on the UC San Diego News Center website from 2017. He was raised in the greater Tijuana, San Diego region. I'm not sure if that literally means that he was sort of living on both sides of the border. It's not clear. I couldn't find anything more about that. But his parents came to the country super poor, and this guy is now in a single generation leaping into one of the top policy spots in the American federal government. and yet considers that his real responsible job is kind of overturning the American system because of its systemic racism. Now, these are my words, but you can, I'll post this in the show notes and people can make up their own minds. It's not an uncommon feature for people to talk both about how horrible the country is and then to note their own success in this country vis-a-vis the difficulties their parents faced back in Latin America. So the more interesting thing here, though, for our conversation I wanted to talk to you about is this guy was Nancy Pelosi's chief staffer on the 2008 recession, the Great Recession, and what he calls Wall Street's recklessness. And I know this is a huge theme for you in Crisis of Responsibility. You write and talk about this often. But Pelosi seems to have drawn purposefully or ignorantly precisely the wrong conclusions from what happened in 2008. Lizarraga, and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to make fun of his name. I'm going to call him Jaime. That I can pronounce very easily. And no disrespect to Jaime. What I want to disrespect is his interpretation of what happened on Wall Street in 2008 with the housing crisis. There's zero mention of sort of the public's responsibility, the public agency's responsibility, especially the federal government's responsibility in helping create the conditions for the real estate meltdown. And so now this guy's headed over to the SEC, where he will have the opportunity to leverage that regulatory's body for at least a couple of years, I presume. But he'll be able to leverage his authority there to carry out some of the policies, which I would argue, and I'm looking to you for either correction or confirmation. This is an important job. This is not nothing. And he comes out of a congressional office that is absolutely hostile to the free market. Correct me if you will, please.
Well, I'm not sure what part you need me to correct on that. It's an important job, that you're right about that, or just that this guy's hostile to markets. You're right about that. What's the part that is subject to dispute?
Well, if I'm exaggerating, he also participated in the restructuring of Puerto Rico's debt. And here I just want to focus for one moment, because Puerto Rico is an awful lot like California. That is, in the sense that both have huge unfunded pension liabilities. California's economy is, of course, light years ahead in terms of its scope and size and dynamism.
I would push back on this, but go ahead.
Please. Well, I just want to point out that there, unfunded public liabilities, that is the government's debt, was so high that Puerto Rico suffered this radical collapse of its financial situation and required the U.S. government to step in and bail it out. And this guy, Jaime, was, again, Pelosi's lead advisor on this and participated and brags about it, that he helped restructure
the debt. He came in, in fairness, to help restructure the debt after the blow-up.
Right.
He wasn't an actor in the indebtedness of Puerto Rico. He didn't create the problem. He came in to try to fix it.
Yes. But in fixing it, he might have observed, oh, my gosh, debt really matters. A lack of free enterprise in the government sphere, or the government's willingness to take on increasing unsustainable debt loads, as we have in California, can come back to bite you in the keister. And having observed all that, he comes away with, well, banks are predatory. Wall Street is the problem.
Yeah, well, by the way, Wall Street bailed out their little ass in Puerto Rico and their debt level. So they can blame Wall Street all they want. Wall Street raised all the debt, and Wall Street's clients got stuck taking 20 cents, 40 cents, 60 cents on the dollar. So the greedy Wall Street people are the ones that had to take the haircut on the bonds. And I could see why people who would be frustrated with creditor rights and frustrated with the letter of the law about what the seniority of the debt structure was supposed to be. That's not the same as greed. That's a frustration apparently with rule of law, which wasn't even followed. I do have a problem, though, when like-minded people, you and I are like-minded on the recklessness of California's debt and the recklessness of the U.S. federal spending and California state spending and unfunded. In California's case, pension liabilities for state employees and retirees, and in the Fed's case, the unfunded pension liability, if you will, of the Social Security and Medicare transfer payment system. But the parallels to California and Puerto Rico end there, because what we rightly have to focus on is both sides of the ledger. California's debt system is more unforgivable because they have a robust revenue model. California has no excuse. Puerto Rico's problem was not merely the assumption. If someone borrows $1 trillion and makes $2 trillion, they don't have a debt problem. If someone borrows $100 and makes $0, they do have a debt problem. So I always want to remind people on the right, economically, that you can't talk about the debt and the spending apart from the revenue. Now, when people say, oh, well, that's what the left says about raising taxes, the difference there is they're not talking about raising revenue. I dispute the idea that it's revenue creation to extract growth from the private sector. So you can get away with a little confiscation and redistribution, but ultimately you end up getting a lower denominator. And this is indisputable economically, that there is a tax rate at which you get a negative return, right? And this is kind of Laffer's curve stuff. But people say, like, the U.S., you know, spending crazy. We're like Zimbabwe. Mm. Or we're going to go like Argentina. Well, you know, Will, it turns out we're not like Zimbabwe. And a lot of people now think the folks who say it are idiots. And they're not going to listen to anything they say, because they said something so stupid that now they don't want to pay any attention to them. Hmm. And the, like, the notion that we become a banana republic, well, I don't know. We do seem to have a pretty high capacity for revenue creation in our country. The state of California, you know as well as I do, for all their unfunded pension liability, for all of their big increase in mandatory non-discretionary spending, the fact of the matter is that the Silicon Valley, real estate, energy, natural resources, if they would kind of let those things roll with their capacity, we have the ability to be a very high revenue creation state. And it would have a very naturally high expense structure, lower than it does, more fiscally responsible, not unfunded on the pension liability side. But I don't have a problem with California spending a lot of money. It just should spend within its means. And its means are very high. Puerto Rico has no revenue model. They have no ability to service any kind of debt. So I guess that's the only thing I'm getting at, is it's not like that it's wrong. It's that it's incomplete. And economically, it makes us vulnerable, because I always want to focus on the growth side. And that bugs me the most about California, that we have capacity to be a very powerful economy, and we extract our future growth and potential with tax and spending policies that push our future out of the state.
Love it. That's the correction I was looking for. Thank you. Another great California news out of Washington, D.C., I would say, and I really do think this is fascinating. Chuck Schumer apparently has expressed doubts about Eric Garcetti's chances for becoming the U.S. ambassador to India. And the reason for this appears to be a lot of anxiety among Democrats and some very versatile Republicans like Chuck Grassley, who have held his nomination pending investigations into claims of sexual harassment inside the mayor's office. It's fascinating that they choose to skip over huge other corruption issues inside the mayor's office and city hall in general in Los Angeles, including, you know, just absolute policy failures we could talk about. But there is real corruption. I mean, we've had some city council members who are under FBI investigation right now and U.S. Attorney General actions because of their work to speed along the development permits of wealthy benefactors who literally paid bribes to get development through. But that's not on the radar, if you will, of people like Chuck Schumer, who are much more concerned about evidence that one of Garcetti's chief aides was in fact sexually harassing men, in one case, an LAPD officer. So Eric Garcetti...
It shouldn't matter who they're harassing, men or women, right?
I'm sorry that I emphasized that, yeah.
No, but I'm saying, is he emphasizing it? Like, is it worse? Is Schumer doing a homophobic thing there? Like, it...
No. They're just saying I had to dig into what the claim was, and looking.
Have you ever heard this about Garcetti?
Yeah, just that this happened in his office, and some, I think, reliable reporting suggests that the mayor didn't know. These are big staffs, and sometimes this stuff can be hidden. But that at the time he may not have known what was going on.
Well, I don't know anything about the sexual harassment thing, and I've never heard it before. And, stuff gets said, and some of it could be true, some could not. But I do know one thing they could bring up to block his nomination. His dad couldn't convict O.J. Simpson.
Ah, Gil.
Or the Menendez brothers, who, I would like to add, admitted that they did it.
That's right.
All OJ did was leave 97 pieces of DNA evidence all over multiple crime scenes. Hmm. But he never said he did it. Lyle and Eric said that they went to the garage and loaded an unloaded gun to go back into the bedroom to shoot their parents to pieces.
Yeah.
And Gil Garcetti couldn't get that convicted. But I guess you can't punish Eric for the inadequacies of the father, right? Eric's got plenty of his own inadequacies. Wasn't he a total COVID douche all the way through?
All the way through. Complete lockdowns, bailing out the school teachers union when they wanted to shut down LA schools, the homeless problem metastasizing, crime sprees all over LA. Eric just completely missing in action on all of these key things.
We're doing a lot of history today. What's the worst non-conviction of the 1990s?
Oh my God!
It's got to be OJ. It's got to be OJ.
Maybe was it the
and the Menendez brothers were a mistrial, not an acquittal, which is why on the retrial they did end up getting convicted. Mm-hmm. But still, that one.
Think about the Rodney King beating. Which
that was
leads,
federal, right?
That's a great question. I do not remember.
No. Ended up doing federal civil rights charges later.
Later, that's
but
right.
But what the acquittal was, and I think two of them were acquitted, and two of them it was mistrial or a hung jury or whatever it was. But yeah, that was those were normal criminal charges. That's the worst too. That's the worst too, because again, everyone knows OJ did it, and there were 94 pieces of DNA evidence, but we all saw the cops do what they did to Rodney King. I still hear people on the right today say like, oh, I don't know, I think that might have been okay. Like, you still hear people defend it.
No, I remember the first time I saw the video, it was like, this can't be right. And I remember hearing the testimony of pro-defense expert witnesses who described the absolute beatdown of Rodney King as, he was resisting. What his resistance comprised.
You didn't see on tape that
he
had gotten up, he was on PCP and he had gotten up and charged the cop before. And I'm like, well, that's true, I didn't. I only saw what happened after.
Yeah.
And I don't think that guy was going to charge the cop again. It's so interesting because the George Floyd thing, you and I talked about in the podcast, and both of us felt the same in watching initially in the aftermath of the man's death. There's just no question to me that the cop was wrong and it was reckless endangerment. And if the cop hadn't put his knee there and kept it there, I think George Floyd would be alive.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not believe that the cop intended to kill him. And I do not necessarily know medically if it's true that he would have died if he didn't have fentanyl and heroin and other things in his system. So, like, very candidly, it's a messy thing, and I'm not one of these people trying to defend the cop. I basically think the cop clearly committed a criminal act, even though I suspect by our understanding of the definition of murder, it probably wasn't, if you're supposed to have some intent somewhere. However, that incident, relative to the Rodney King one, I mean, I don't even know what people are talking about. And I was a really immature conservative. I would just instinctively take the right side on anything and pro cop and pro law and order and pro, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I remember my dad and I talking about it, and he was like, if you come into contact with some joker trying to defend the cops on this one, you got to understand those people are damaging our cause because this is so completely indefensible for any reasonable human being with an iota of moral compass.
All right, RFC listeners, warm up your emails. Here they come.
Oh, by the way, if we get an email, you got to tell me. I'm not going to read it. If you get an email from someone defending the cops and the Rodney King thing, let me know. I bet we will. I bet we will get some.
Let's turn to other things that can kill you. The abortion bill brought by Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks. This is Assembly Bill 2223. That's 2223. I think any fair reading of this bill, David, it really allows women who cause the death of their child, including a newborn, to escape any kind of police investigation, any sort of law enforcement investigation into the claim that they may have actually murdered their child. Wick says she brought this bill because she found two women who were, in fact, she believes, unreasonably charged with the death of their newborns. And for that reason, has written a bill in which the language seems very, very clear that women should not be prosecuted for a pregnancy loss. Well, in the case of the two women that she references, both of these women were pregnant and using meth with real frequency, the sort of frequency that would have us call them addicts. And their children were born in both cases, either stillborn or severely disabled and soon dead. And Wicks finds their subsequent prosecution just really deeply troubling. So she's written this over, based on these two cases, she's written this very broad bill that would really just decriminalize any sort of, they call it perinatal death. And it just struck a lot of us, I think. I'm looking at the story from Katie Grimes on California Globe. The headline is Infanticide or, quote, Pregnancy Loss. Abortion Bill Passes Assembly Judiciary Committee. Now, what's fascinating, David, is a lot of people are saying, look, this is infanticide, pure and simple. If people behave badly and inadvertently cause the death of their child. Again, this goes back to what you were just saying about George Floyd. You could call this manslaughter at the very least. You did not perhaps intend to kill your child, but that's manslaughter. Wick's bill goes farther. You can't even investigate to determine what she calls, let me see if I can find this thing, it's self-managing an abortion. So, and again, they keep using the phrase in this bill of perinatal, which Wicks is constantly trying to redefine as, no, I really only meant while in utero, but all the definitions of perinatal and one of the deaths in these meth cases appear to be cases that are postpartum, you know, after the baby's born. This is a child now. I don't think anybody disagrees with that, that once the child's out of the mother's womb, like I thought we all sort of agreed, okay, you know, that's a clear marker. You've survived the traumatic experience of being born, which is probably hard on a lot of us. So I just find this fascinating that Wicks is, you know, trying to beat this back, any claim that this legitimizes or legalizes infanticide, by saying, no, it doesn't. And the media have been tremendously helpful in really sort of arguing on her behalf that this is fake news to declare that this is infanticide. So, David, any thoughts on this bill and whether this really constitutes infanticide?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, do you remember who Frances Schaeffer is, Will?
No, I don't.
Frances Schaeffer was a Christian intellectual who, in a lot of ways, may be the modern father of the Christian right, even though he was a philosopher and a theologian, and he spent a lot of his adult life in Le Bris, Switzerland. But as far as a lot of his teachings on Christian engagement with culture, some of the more street-level pop guys were kind of influenced by a lot of his contribution to Christian thought and cultural apologetics in the 60s and 70s. But he did a book and a subsequent kind of docu-series called Whatever Happened to the Human Race, post Roe, where he basically was suggesting, like, this is the slippery slope of where these things could go. And he was making this ethical argument for once you kind of abandon this kind of Christian and Catholic theology of human life, where it will be headed. I will tell you that the most ardent defenders of abortion rights when I was a younger person would be disgusted by this idea of what this Buffy Wicks little she-devil is proposing. This is, of course, infanticide, because that's the definition of infanticide. That a woman can do anything, I thought the point of Roe and abortion was to medicalize it and to state that drug abuse and other behavioral acts and things that are acts of aggression cannot be considered illegalities is the most bizarre form of ethics, except for, I guess, to Schaefer's point, it's not bizarre because they have simply fallen down the slippery slope of absolutely no regard for human life.
What's interesting, Katie does a great job of pointing out that Buffy the Vampire is aided and abetted in this effort by Attorney General Rob Bonta, who has said that really, let me see if I can find the great line here. Yes, he says Penal Code 187, that's the section that, you know, describes homicide, defines murder as the unlawful killing of a human being or a fetus with malice aforethought. Reference to a fetus was added in 1970 when the California legislature amended Section 187, Bonta said, and he reiterates, the legislature did not intend to include a pregnant person's own actions that might result in a miscarriage or stillbirth. That would seem to contradict directly what you're talking about here with Francis Schaefer, that, you know, any action that leads to the, it's remarkable to me, because if you're in a car crash and somebody, you know, a drunk driver hits you and you're pregnant and your child dies in utero, that's considered a homicide or at least manslaughter. And yet here we have Buffy saying, you know, not good enough. These poor women who used meth during their pregnancies and then as a result had children die. That's not included here. I'm intrigued by all of the outlets that have jumped on this story to support her claim really badly that this is not, in fact, condoning or legalizing infanticide. You've got the Associated Press and Reuters and Agence France-Presse, AFP, PolitiFact, each one of them using only Wick's claims about what her bill says rather than the bill itself to defend the bill against charges that it permits infanticide. Can we switch to energy policy here, David?
Yeah, remember, by the way, the governor of Virginia a couple years ago said the same thing about if the baby's born, we'll kind of keep it warm, I think he said. We'll keep it comfortable,
yes.
Like get a blanket or something before we kind of let it die on the...
Right.
This is not good.
Very ancient world. Very ancient world. Set the child out on the step and hope that it survives or it doesn't on its own.
Yeah, I mean, medieval morality is supposed to be looked down upon not just for its lack of technological prowess, but for its lack of moral advancement. It's very disgusting.
We've talked a lot on this podcast, David, about the fact that Gavin Newsom's constant claims about producing 100% clean energy is bogus. I've talked at some length about lithium mining, which Newsom is now saying is going to rescue the California economy because there's huge lithium deposits down beneath the Salton Sea. I wanted to point out that one of our listeners sent in this just absolutely fabulous story from the Associated Press. Wind energy company kills 150 eagles. Here's the lead graph. A subsidiary of one of the largest U.S. providers of renewable energy pleaded guilty to criminal charges and was ordered to pay over $8 million in fines and restitution after at least 150 eagles were killed at its wind farms in eight states, including California. The others are Wyoming, New Mexico, North Dakota, Colorado, Michigan, Arizona, and Illinois. I tweeted out that, you know, every time Gavin Newsom talks about clean energy, an eagle loses its life. So it's just, you know, absolutely fascinating to me that you've got Joe Biden, Gavin Newsom, the left pushing this notion that there's some such a thing as clean energy. All energy is at some level, let's call it tragic, because we have to mine it. It is indeed polluting, all of it, including all this stuff that is supposedly renewable and yet leads to the unintentional but predictable destruction of natural lands and habitats. Just, you know, sort of remarkable. And in a related story, wanted to point out that all of us who got our latest utility bills may have received a climate tax credit. And I'll post the notification because I had to go look it up. I saw it on the bill, and a listener in SoCal sent this to me. He was the guy who sort of tipped me off to it. It says, this April, your utility bill will include a credit identified as the California Climate Credit for residential utility customers. And the similar one for small business utility customers. Households and small businesses throughout the state, including yours, Will Swaim and David Bonson, will receive this credit on their utility bills. It's paid as a flat rate amount twice a year. Now, why do they give us this tax credit, David? They give it to us because it's the receipts from a state program that requires power plants, natural gas providers, and other large industries that emit greenhouse gases to buy carbon pollution permits. This is the cap and trade system that we've all heard so much about. So we tax all these quote unquote polluters. We take the revenue in, and then because the price of our energy goes up, the state rebates some of that cash to us. So in other words, we're rebated money that the state collects from polluters so that we can continue to pollute. Rather than just reducing the tax and freeing up industry to produce jobs, energy, et cetera, the state confiscates this cash and then gives us just a little bit back. And I find this just a weird thing that's right in line, and this is what the listener was telling me to focus on. You and I talked about the gas tax rebate and how Kevin Kiley tried to get the governor, tried to get the assembly and the Senate. Kevin Kiley out of Placer County, now running for Congress, an assemblyman from that area. But Kevin had gone to the assembly and begged them to eliminate the gas tax, or at least hit pause on it. And his assembly brethren not only resisted that effort, but hijacked his bill and stuffed it full of new oil taxes, new taxes on energy. And I pointed out that Governor Newsom's response to spiking gas prices was to promise that he would rebate everybody who owns a car. And do you remember your wonderful breakdown of the gas tax rebate, David? Maybe you can reprise that here for us.
My breakdown? What do you mean?
Yeah, the fact that it goes to, you pointed out that it
electric
goes to everybody who owns a car.
Electric car owners.
Yeah, and every car owner, right? So if I own, sure, I don't know, 16 cars because I'm wealthy enough to own 16 cars.
You mean the regressive nature of it, yeah.
Right. Yes. So that if you're poor and you own one car, you get a $400 roughly, a $400 rebate. If you own 16 cars, you get 16 cars times $400.
So Jay Leno would get like $1 million.
$1 million, yeah. So this weird habit of the governor refusing to simply eliminate a tax so that he can keep himself in the position of monarch, redistributing cash to his pet projects like electric car owners, is the same principle here, that rather than just eliminate the tax on businesses that are quote-unquote polluters, which would lower our energy costs for everybody, the government wants to continue to confiscate and then to be the kind of monarchical delivery system for saying, here's your money back. You can have a little bit of money. This will help me. It turns us into serfs of a kind, I think. And it's this weird habit of California government to treat us this way and then to pretend that it's just a gift and it's going to clean up the environment.
Yeah, this is his playbook. He plays it consistently.
Got to say that. Yeah. Let's turn to COVID. I know you don't like to talk about it, but there was a great story in the Wall Street
Journal.
Is there
a COVID 20?
Is there a what, buddy?
A COVID 20?
You mean like as opposed to COVID 19?
Are you talking COVID 19?
Did I say 20?
No, I'm wondering why. I assume there's a new COVID if we're talking about it.
No, I'm talking about the Wall Street Journal's wonderful report on a study just out of, what's this group called? It's the authors of a University of Chicago economist, Casey Mulligan and Stephen Moore and Phil Kirpin of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity.
Yeah, I'm on the committee.
You are?
I am.
Oh my gosh, we'll talk about this, brother. I had no idea.
What do you want to know? Well, first tell the story of this article, and okay, I'll tell you the history of the committee.
Study comes out from the National Bureau of Economic Research, and according to the, here's the Wall Street Journal, it is the most comprehensive
study. This is what I sent you about the outperformance of Florida to California.
There you go.
Go ahead.
So you talk about how the study was performed, that it will be utterly apparent immediately, I think, to most of our listeners, that this is the metric you and I have been advocating all along with regard to shutdowns and the economic costs therein versus the lives saved because of that lockdown.
Yeah, it's essentially a model-driven approach to input medical data and economic data so that the weighting reflects the whole story instead of ignoring trade-offs. And Casey's a very honest guy and a very good analyst, and he was kind of behind this particular effort. But once one views it that way, rather than the dishonesty of data that has come from some of these other studies, I think it was Slate or Salon or The Atlantic or one of the usual cast of characters, it's really a blowout in how substantially better Florida performed when you are allowing for economic calculation.
And why, just, you know, to ask the obvious question for those who may not be following a story like this, why should we include the economic impact of COVID shutdowns along with COVID death reports?
Well, the reason is trade-offs, right? And so let's start. This is the way Laffer's curve was developed. Can we avoid any death from car accidents by totally criminalizing the ownership or operation of an automobile?
Yes.
If you use the power of the state to prevent any driving of any cars, what will your automobile deaths be? It will be zero. So if all I said was, hey, this state did it and they had zero auto deaths, and we then said, period, that's the end of the story, would anyone consider that a comprehensive or useful report academically, intellectually, legally, for public policy, for economic and financial impact? Or would most people say, okay, well, what did you give up? You gave up ambulances, you gave up the
trucks,
functioning of a commuter economy, right? And so that's an extreme example that's identical, though, in principle. It's just maybe you bring the numbers in a little bit, that you have to adjust for the trade-offs in any decision. There will be, by the way, trade-offs from COVID that are not measurable right now. Now, they're looking at current data. We've done this in Sweden and Denmark as well. We can adjust for Sweden COVID numbers. You know, all things being equal, let's just make this real simple before we get more complicated with Casey's study. If I told you Sweden and France each had 100 deaths for every million people, I'm making it up, they each had 100 deaths for a million people, and you go, okay, so they had the same COVID damage. In mortality, they had the same COVID damage. The death per capita is the same. If that were, I'm making up to make a point. You go, okay, I guess it's the same. But then if I said, but France's GDP contracted 10%, and Sweden's contracted 5%, then you'd have to say, well, wait a second, I guess it wasn't the same. How did they have the same mortality, but with such a different economic impact? And some of the metrics that matter to that economic impact are things like schooling, mental health, economic output, trade. And, you know, look, the University of Pennsylvania, which is an Ivy League school, the Wharton Business School, has already done a study that is really fascinating, estimating billions of dollars and full basis points off of future GDP from the current into the future, from the current elementary school students who missed out on 2 years of brick and mortar education. I think that it is abundantly logical that in a world of trade-offs, we analyze health data in the context of economic data. And I think everybody intuitively knows this. Otherwise, we would walk around talking about how wonderful it is that we eliminated plane deaths by eliminating planes.
Sure.
We allow plane deaths because we want the benefits that planes provide the broader economy, both in terms of life-giving, right? Like planes can be used to save lives in a whole lot of situations, and obviously economic opportunity.
So the study concludes, not to bury the lead too much here, but the study concludes that Florida ranked, so when you rank the best performers from 1 to 50, the 50 being the worst, Florida ranks 13th in the study, very close to the top, in other words. California is at 47. Mm. And yet we have a governor who goes around saying that we led the world on the response to COVID, and we've got a 47 ranking.
My view about that, though, is that politicians are going to spin anything, right?
Sure. And the public will spin right along with them. And, of course, the media has been extraordinarily helpful in covering Newsom's losses and sort of glossing over his own personal shortcomings on his behavior, French laundry. So I found the study absolutely fascinating.
I think you're being sarcastic, though.
I am.
Yeah, I think the media hit Newsom pretty good on French laundry.
I'm sorry. No, I wasn't being sarcastic about that. I think they were very forgiving. They pointed it out over time. I mean, I just read way too many stories.
Yeah, I'm saying I think they hit him pretty hard.
Okay, so difference of opinion. I guess it's subjective. My own sense is that that was dismissed as sort of nutpicking by the right. Because I remember the recall campaign, this story... Yeah. Whenever it came up, was like, look, so the guy had dinner one time. He apologized. It's over. Look at how well we've done in every other metric. The response has been brilliant.
But I don't think we're talking about facts here. And you and I were in the same position about the recall. And here's how I remember it. And again, if you could send me an article where it's like clear that there was some real minimizing of what happened at French Laundry. But what I remember was a lot of the left-wing press saying Gavin Newsom is being recalled and they're taking his huge misstep with French Laundry and now trying to exacerbate it and removing him from office. And that there was this simultaneous, this recall is ridiculous position combined with Newsom really stepped in it at French Laundry. Like I hate the left-wing press more than anyone. I don't recall them minimizing French Laundry. I think they were embarrassed by it themselves.
Yeah. No, that's fair. Yes, you're right. That they would take that as the only evidence of a misstep in the COVID protocol the governor insisted on. His emergency authority, the shutdown of the economy.
Right.
And they would say, okay, so there was this one thing.
Yeah, right. You would say churches were closed down for over a year. They're like... Yeah, but he did that French Laundry dinner.
Yeah.
And even then they were more upset that there were lobbyists there.
Yes, that's true. Remember. Wow. Glad you reminded me of that. Hey, let's turn to the sort of the woke curriculum here, and we'll talk about all things identity. We've talked a little bit about reparations and the phoniness of the distinction there and almost the impossibility of proving that you were personally descended from a slave. It's very, very difficult. But anyway, we've talked enough about reparations for the nonce. I wanted to talk about this. Here's the headline in, I believe this is the Sacramento Bee, or is this the Mercury News, probably? Mercury News. California math wars get ugly. Accusations of racism and harassment ignite battle between Stanford and Cal profs. Here's the breakdown of the story behind that headline. A Stanford University math professor has been at the forefront of rewriting the
state's... You said between Stanford and Cal profs?
Profs, P-R-O-F. Yeah, professors.
The band is on the field.
Yeah. Is that what they say at Stanford?
Well, you don't know what I'm talking about right now?
No, I guess I don't. I'm embarrassed. Can we just end the podcast right here?
You know about John Sutter and what he had for dinner at his like 40th birthday. And you don't know the most famous college football play of all time?
Oh, no. No, I just always loved the Stanford band, but please tell me.
When Cal had to lateral like 50 times to score the touchdown when they beat Stanford, Elway's final year, and the whole band was on the field, the crowd was on the field, and Cal ran a touchdown.
No.
Oh, my God.
Are you ashamed?
No, this is not. I'm not being funny. This is going to take some time.
Talk.
You don't know about this play.
No, not paying attention. I was
the most famous college football play of all time, ever in the history of college football.
You talk. I'm looking.
I don't have anything else to say. What were you doing in the early 1980s, and also every minute since?
In the early 1980s,
that's incriminating.
I was a member of the Communist Party USA. I was playing in a punk rock band, and
say no more. Really, you've explained attention. It. Okay, yeah. So the band is on the field. Is a moment that you missed, and that most of our listeners right now know exactly what I'm talking about. And so when you're setting up your story, which I interrupted with Stanford Cal conflict with professors, I thought that it would be really appropriate to bring on this historical moment that you don't know what I'm referring to.
Yeah, this is really a Bob Hope moment where you're having to explain the joke. I'm so sorry.
No, it's not. All right. This is calling into question our future.
Our friendship?
Certainly our podcast.
Yeah. Hey, so here's the background in the story. There's a Stanford University professor named Joe Bowler, and Joe, a lady, Joe. I think I'm allowed to say that still, that she's a lady. She's led the effort to rewrite the state's math framework with a stated focus on students of color and English learners. Her work is now the catalyst for a proposed statewide math framework similar to San Francisco's, which pushed Algebra 1 to the ninth grade. There had been this opportunity for kids to take Algebra 1 while still in middle school. So Professor Joe, because I can't pronounce her last name, has been pushing this thing. And activists who do not like this new math curriculum posted a contract that she had with a Southern California school district in Oxnard, where she was earning $5,000 an hour to make a presentation on sort of the woke math curriculum. Well, this is where it got really interesting. A math professor at Stanford saw this thing, and I want to point this out. This guy's name is Jelani Nelson. Jelani Nelson is a black man who teaches electrical engineering and computer science at Berkeley. And he reposted that same document, at which point the professor at Stanford, that's Professor Joe, she says after the retweet, she contacted Nelson, the Berkeley professor, notifying him that police and lawyers were taking up, quote, the sharing of private details about me on social media. She included in her email this warning: I was shocked to see that you're taking part in spreading misinformation and harassing me online. So what did our Berkeley professor of engineering and computer science do? He screenshot that and included it in a tweet and said, look, this lady is now threatening to call the police on a black man. This white lady is threatening to call the police on a black man for simply reporting what's in a public document. She denied that there was any racist intent. She didn't know that he's black. I don't know. I looked at his Facebook, or rather his Twitter account. That's in his profile picture. She immediately said he purposefully misunderstood this thing. She never intended to go after him because he's black, but he was clearly already trolling her and playing her game in a very important way to point out that what she was trying to do was suppress his right to publish a public document that showed she had a financial interest in getting this math curriculum going because she has this lucrative side hustle in promoting this curriculum to school districts as a consultant. So she says, I just wanted him to know that the posts by a teacher sharing my address have been sent to police and lawyers as a courtesy. because I thought it better that he did not engage with this other teacher. He changed that to say I was threatening him with police and lawyers. I was not. She said she's just devastated by these accusations. This professor, meanwhile, at Berkeley, Professor Nelson, who has criticized the lack of people of color among math framework authors. Like he's pointing out, this professor Nelson is pointing out that the professors who are all rewriting the math curriculum so that it's more woke and social justice oriented are mostly white people. And he says, what must not get lost in this troubling incident is the much larger issue of K-12 math education in the state of California. The California math framework proposal is a misguided revision of state guidelines on math education that will negatively affect tens of millions of Californians, including my own two children. This pathway leaves students unprepared for quantitative four-year college degrees via a newly proposed pathway for teaching mathematics that lacks essential content. So we have the interesting situation once again in which a black professor, a professor of engineering and computer science who happens to be black and a man, is pointing out the racial disparity of the commission rewriting this this math curriculum. That's really the story, David. And I just wanted to point out that this math curriculum that is being rammed through the California state government and our Department of Education really is very controversial, and not among white people, among white people. In fact, white people are its largest, its greatest supporters at this point. It's black people who are saying you're depriving our kids of a real chance to excel in these very difficult quantitative fields.
I'm with you 100%. I'm with him. Yes, indeed. The soft bigotry of low expectations once again.
Yeah. Hey, I know we're running late on time here. Do you have time for one more story?
Which one are you going to do, the BLM?
I think so.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's do it.
We should do BLM, and then we should do the LA mayor race real quick.
Okay, very good. So Black Lives Matter, the headline here in the Washington Examiner. Let's go to the New York story, New York Magazine story. I find this story interesting because it's an investigative reporter who also happens to be black, who has done this deep dive investigation into what happened with all of the money that people donated to Black Lives Matter. Some of it apparently has ended up in the purchase of very, very expensive homes in places like L.A., where Black Lives Matter activists bought a $6 million house.
There's $6 million homes in the hood?
These are not in the hood, brother.
No, where are they?
Let me see, where is this
Normandy
house?
And Crenshaw?
No, it's not anywhere near Normandy or Crenshaw or South Central in any way. I'll just read from the lead because it's pretty great. On a sunny day late last spring, three leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, and Melina Abdullah, sat around a table on the patio of an expensive house in Southern California, recording a YouTube video to mark the first anniversary of George Floyd's murder and discussed their racial justice work. They were sitting on the patio of a very pricey home, and I have to dig in here. I'm sorry that I don't have that right here to hand. But his investigation showed not only did they buy a $6 million house, but that the Black Lives Matter Foundation has failed to provide financials that are required under state and federal law for the use of this donor-driven tsunami of revenue. The organization got like $90 million in 2020, 2021. And then we find that they're spending this money on...
The L.A. chapter got $90 million.
No, I'm sorry, the National did.
No, the National got more than $90 million.
Well, maybe you're right. I think it was just this BLM. It's an L.A.-based group, this foundation. So maybe that's what you're thinking.
I think BLM nationally got more than $90 million.
You may be right. Here's the key point. Not only did these guys spend $6 million of whatever else they got here to buy a home in a very upscale neighborhood, they then, in emails, which this reporter at New York Magazine, Sean Campbell, he gets these emails that show the members of the leadership group of Black Lives Matter doing everything they can to hide the ownership and to mask the services provided in, quote unquote, maintaining this home, services provided by family members of BLM. Now, the organization came out and told Campbell and other reporters, this is all BS. It's driven by the far right and by white supremacists who've threatened our lives. Mm-hmm. And all we're really trying to do is keep this home confidential because it's a safe house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Campbell says that doesn't really line up because you're recording a video, you'll remember from the opening, a YouTube video in which you show yourselves sitting at this home mm-hmm. in ways that are easily identified as a specific home in a specific place. And here's another one from Patrice Cullors, one of the BLM leaders, making a peach cobbler in the kitchen, the lavishly appointed kitchen of this $6 million home in L.A. So an interview with Sean Campbell, he says, look, I'm doing this more out of regret than anger. Because I support the idea that Black Lives Matter. I support social justice. But this abuse of the finances suggests that these people have not been truthful. They have not been honest, and they have profited abundantly from the use of from money that was given to them to promote social justice. So then the group comes out and says, well, yes, it's true. We were recording things inside this very lavishly appointed home, but that was only to really help establish the place as a creative center for people of color who are into the creative arts. They want it to be a recording studio, a film studio, and like an artist's studio where people can create great art aimed at expanding social justice. It's just a complete mess. And we've even had Rob Bonta, who we excoriate regularly on this podcast and just did vis-a-vis abortion stuff. But what's really fascinating to me is that even Rob Bonta has said, like, look, this group's finances are so extraordinarily out of whack, and their reporting on this is borderline illegal now at this point, and they can't even raise cash in California because of their failure to file in time. So, you know, it's just one of these important stories I did not want to miss. That is, you know, the old notion that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. These people had no oversight. It reminds me, frankly, of a donor that has given generously to CPC but could not about a year and a half ago because he'd been grifted on the Trump stolen election stuff. That some group showed up and said, we're raising money for Trump's legal defense. He gave them $400,000 and the group disappeared within days. This is the same kind of grift, it seems, based on this reporting. That, you know, you tell donors one thing and you use the money for something completely different.
Well, that should be appalling. And the fact of the matter is, for anyone who has any experience in the donor world or organizations that receive a huge amount of money above and beyond their capacity as an organization to deploy it above and beyond their actual infrastructure, their, you know, personnel responsibility and experience, it's inevitable. Now, there are just out and out grifters that are running explicit scams. And I think you referenced one on the Trump stolen election thing. It's really, frankly, what destroyed the Tea Party movement is I don't think the ideology died as quickly as the grift killed it. There were just so many grifter organizations that were fraudulent. You know, the right and the left have a lot of these organizations and people that are just used car salesmen, except for significantly worse than that. BLM, according to The Economist, and I don't see how this can be correct, brought in $10 billion in 2020. The LA Times has gone after BLM about not being transparent on how the national finances get distributed out to their local chapters. They have a very complicated web of each local chapter having a different P&L from the national and how the national, what its P&L looks like. So there's a lot of opaqueness there. I'm against the cause, you know, their tactics and their ideology based on what their own statement of faith is, if you will. But I would just simply point out that large organizations that are doing everything above the line in terms of their financials, transparency flows out of their culture. And when there are attempts to hide and obfuscate, it's not because they happen to have really high opinions about privacy. They're hiding something. Mm-hmm. And $6 million homes and the grift and greed and other things that go along with it are par for the course here. And I think it'll end up being the undoing of this organization. Not the slogan, not the sticker, not the cause, but I think that the institution of BLM will be dead soon enough, because that's what happens when you have effectively grifters running it.
Let's talk about the LA mayor's race. One of the emerging candidates has so shocked the left that they're doing everything it can to eliminate this guy, the way that Larry Elder was eliminated. He's not black, but his name is Rick Caruso. I believe you actually know Rick Caruso.
I've met him a couple times.
Yeah. He is. Here's the lead from the Daily Caller. Billionaire real estate developer and former Republican, I guess he's now an independent, is a point ahead of his opponent, Democratic California Representative Karen Bass, in the L.A. mayor's race. He's only a little bit ahead of Bass. She is a black woman. We'll get to her. But Caruso's, sort of out there in front. He could self-finance this thing, I think, forever. You know something about Rick Caruso and the mayor's race. What's your take?
Well, I think that I'm seeing the media now, try to say, can this Republican beat him? And, of course, he's not. But he was a former Republican. But that, I don't know how I feel about that. I was a little discouraged because I actually think he can win. And then I'm seeing right-wing media cover it. Has it gotten so bad in California that now they're just desperate for a Republican to come fix things? And I'm like, no. I remember when you guys said the recall was going to go through. Just national media, please stay out of this one. Because
you're not helping.
They're all looking for a story so much. And the reality is, if he can win, it will be as a fixer, as competent, as technocratic. Mm-hmm. He's not running as I'm the Republican coming to fix the Democrat problems. And that's sort of how Schwarzenegger ran after Gray Davis. And that got him elected back in 2002 or whatever, or three, but it hasn't worked since, and it's not the state of California now. There's nobody looking to Republicans to fix problems in California. There are people looking for policy solutions. There's not enough yet. School choice, I still think it has more work to go, but we'll get there. We got to keep fighting the unions, doing all the things you're doing at Cal Policy Center every day. But this narrative about LA is about to elect a Republican, it's just kind of not true. But I like Caruso. I hope he wins. But that's not about California starting to pivot. It just isn't.
No, I'll point out that the crime anxiety is so substantial that even Karen Bass, again, a Democrat, member of Congress, famously progressive, is anti-crime, always talks tough about crime, probably because she is really tied closely to the police union in Los Angeles. She is our, longtime listeners will remember when we spoke, a while ago. She is the author of a bill which she has since kind of abandoned to others because it was looking bad for her during the George Floyd summer. But it was H.R. 3225, and that would have imposed police unions that are common in states like California, Illinois, New York, and elsewhere, would have imposed those nationwide. It would have been a federal requirement that police organize themselves in unions, which then, of course, become Democratic money machines. That's how they work, even in California. So Karen Bass is talking a tough line on violence in the streets of L.A., and I think that's what's really more remarkable here, is that you have a Democrat and an independent, Caruso and Bass. You have the two of them really talking about crime in a way that and about homelessness. Caruso's all over the homelessness problem, too. He's a little bit like Michael Schellenberger, who's also running for governor. We'll get to him in one of our future episodes. Just to hit a couple of other candidates who are running, and let's talk about these in the future, David. But my colleague at CPC, at California Policy Center, Lance Christensen, who's been in Sacramento for years as a conservative public finance guy, chief of staff for a very conservative state senator here from Orange County, John Morlock, and now works at CPC. Lance is running for state superintendent of public instruction. He has the name identity of Will Swaim, which means that, you know, most people won't be familiar with him. It is a statewide office, but he's running against Tony Thurmond, who is not really well-liked in the media for his failure to do almost anything of value during the school's closure that Newsom imposed. The other guy who's interesting, I mentioned Michael Schellenberger, who's running for governor against Newsom. I think he's a really interesting guy. We'll talk more about him in the future. We've cited his stories. He's the author of San Francisco. He's a doctor. Very, very bright guy. The other guy who's interesting is somebody I think you also know, Lanhee Chen, who's running for state controller. And Lanhee Chen is a Republican who has a real gift for talking about the kinds of issues that I think are characteristic of California elections: diversity and equality of opportunity, not equity in the sense the left has come to say that. And it's interesting because Chen, though a Republican, very really bright guy, who worked in both, I think, the George W. Bush and the Obama White Houses in the finance side of things, is running for controller. And Democrats are starting to look to him as a guy who might actually become the next state controller. So we'll talk more about all those guys and other races coming up. David, anything else you want to hit before we sign off?
Well, if you haven't watched the video of the Cal Stanford game from 1982, by next week, then this podcast is over.
I will not only watch it, I will post it in the show notes. How's that?
I've sent you the link, my friend.
Thank you, buddy. That's all we have time for today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That helps boost our profile. Please email us with your comments and your story suggestions. Loads of readers do this every week. I'm sorry, readers, listeners. The habits of 30 years of talking about an audience as readers. I'm so sorry. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, our engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, Hey Boys, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.